Good morning. I'm Laurie Skelton, in for Larry Mueller for this edition of Garden Talk. And joining us this morning is Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer of the Department of Horticulture for UW-Madison and Extension. And we will be happy to take your questions, respond to your experiences in the garden from this past summer and the garden ahead of us at 1-800-642-1234. That's toll-free from anywhere you're listening, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email your questions to talk@wpr.org. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Laurie.
Pleasure to see you this morning. And before we get started, we've already got calls coming in, but before we get started, let me just ask, what happened this summer that is going to affect whatever we do for the next 3 to 6 months?
Well, one of the biggest things I think that impacted us this summer was just simply the lack of rain. I mean, we had plenty, but it all came at one time. We had flooding issues, but we've gone through some extensive periods without rain. And during the fall period, the trees are preparing for winter, and you'll notice that some are already turning color prematurely, indication that they're under some type of stress, and I would guess it most likely is water stress. We're encouraging homeowners to start watering their trees at least on a once a week basis. You need about 6/10 of a gallon for every square foot of tree canopy, so you can do your math in terms of how much water you need. And this needs to be applied about once a week, all the way up until we have freeze-up. So that's probably going to be the biggest impact. For those working in the perennial gardens and doing any lifting and working with those plant materials, we highly encourage them also to water that perennial flower bed probably 3 days before they plan on actually working in there. This will soften the soil up to a certain degree, and you'll have less damage to your perennial structures that you're lifting.
All right. Well, as I say, we're starting to fill up the phone lines. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And we will begin this morning with Linda in Black Earth. Good morning. Hello, Linda?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. I have a 30 by 50 garden that I have nothing in. I've just tilled it. Nothing's growing in it. I want to know, what can I plant in there to have it covered and compete with the weeds all winter, and then I can just till it in the spring?
Well, there's a couple of very good options, and we're seeing more and more gardeners doing this, applying some type of cover crop to that garden. Just regular oats that the farmers produce is a very good cover crop. You can go down to the local feed mill and buy a 50-pound bag, which is more than enough to cover. But what's unique about that is it'll grow all the way up until freeze-up, and then it will winter kill. And next spring, you can work in the green material or green manure materials back into the soil. It also helps trap the nutrients that are there in the soil by trapping them into the plant material, and you have a less opportunity for them to be leached down into the lower soil. Some people use the annual ryegrass as another type of cover crop. That also will usually winter kill, and you don't have to worry about it. As you get into some of the fescues and some of those types of plant materials, they will grow, but they will sometimes overwinter, and then you have to deal with trying to kill those down or knock them down this coming spring. So I usually rely on some of the oats products, and it grows very fast. It's up in about 3-4 days. You can see it's heavier than normal, and what you're doing is adding good green plant tissue or green manure material to the soil.
And that's going to work for all of Wisconsin, even up north where they've already started to have some frost?
Oh, yes.
All right.
And that'll germinate when soil temperatures are above 35 degrees. And so you could even do this probably towards the end of October and still have some success.
All right. Linda, thank you very much for joining us this morning. And Don in Madison has a question. Hello, Don.
Hello. I was wondering if you could give me some advice on moving some 75-year-old peonies to a new spot, and also some arborvitae pyramidalis. They're not that old. They're still movable. Is there anything I should be doing special? And a second question about the peonies is, what kind of light tolerance do they have, do they need?
Well, first of all, for the light tolerance, they perform best under full sunlight, and that is because the sunlight will and the light intensity stimulates flower bud formation. I will also mention that when you usually transplant peonies, that growing season that follows, many times they do not have very many blooms, if at all, and that's because some of the stresses in the movement of the peonies usually result in limited flowering of the plant material. The best time, October would be a good time to move those. Make sure that you water them very well before you dig them. Usually we say right after a good hard frost where the green tissue is frozen, and you can lift those tuberous root structures and move them on. Or in the spring before we have any growth. After this snow melts, soil thaws, you have probably about a five-week window in there that you can move those plants successfully. Now, whether you're moving now, make sure that you place those on a good watering schedule. If you're happening to be moving into an area that's a little bit lower or wetter, you might even want to consider raising the soil mound where your peonies are going to exist so that they are in a better drain situation. As for the pyramidal arborvitae, again, moving in the spring would probably be your best success, and I would do that right after the soil thaws.
Does that cover it, Don?
Yes, uh-huh.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling today. 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or you can email at talk@wpr.org. Bob Tomesch joining us today on Garden Talk, and Jerry from Green Bay is on the phone. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Bob, this would question would be in regards to sterilizing natural black soil in an electric dirt sterilizer. It's it takes about 50 gallons at a time, stainless steel. And by sterilizing the soil, and by the way, I do mix it with a soilless mix to kind of make a little bit better mix for nursery potted plants, such as, deciduous or even perennials. Does it do any harm to the micronutrients in the earth, in the black soil?
It doesn't do any harm to the micronutrients because they are chemical structures. But what with your sanitation process, you are killing any of the existing microflora or your microbes, etc., in that soil. But I assume that you're using this mix for starting plants in the spring or bedding plants or plants indoors. And so sterilization is usually a pretty good step to get rid of any of those fungi and those harmful types of critters that might be in there.
Of like how long I should cook it at about 180 degrees, it has a thermostat on, 6 hours, 8 hours?
I don't know exactly. That was something I knew years ago, but I didn't have to talk about that very often. But usually you want to get that temperature up there in that range. Sometimes we even suggest getting it up closer to if you're using, I am assuming you're using dry heat as opposed to steam heat. But we want to get that temperature up there, and I think it's about 2 hours or so. If you kind of do a little Googling, you can find that information or check with the company that built the sterilizing unit that you have, and I'm sure they'll have some recommendations for that unit.
Okay. Can I ask one more question about the peonies? Why do they get the black spotting or the black sections on the leaves, Bob?
That's a fungal organism, usually Septoria or one of the other fungal diseases. It's common all over. Some years it's worse than others, depending on the conditions that we have. If it's very wet and humid for a wet period of time, usually in the spring and May when they first start growing, that allows those fungal structures to get started on the leaf tissue. Preventative methods, choices you have. Of course, there's some fungal pesticides that you can use. The other thing is if they're in full sun or spreading the peonies out so they get better air movement through there, those are some applied types of techniques that will reduce that problem. Also, certain varieties are more prone to it than others.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
All right. Jerry in Green Bay, thank you for joining us this morning. Next on the line is Dan in White Lake with a question about blueberries. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. My blueberries aren't doing it. They're 3 or 4 years old, and they just aren't doing much. No berries, plenty of leaves, no berries. And so I'm wondering, I think the pH is not low enough. Is there anything else you can do to lower the pH significantly, but this miracid, and how much miracid do you have to put on?
Mm. Ooh, that's some tough questions there. But first of all, I think your biggest problem is not the pH issue. You can grow blueberries fairly successfully all the way up to a pH of 6. But the issue with blueberries is that, one, keep them very well mulched. I usually suggest that people apply about 4 inches of bark chips over that growing bed.
Four inches?
Yes.
Okay.
And then the other thing is blueberries are in the family that do not have very good root structures or even root hairs for absorbing water. And so you have to place them on a watering program at least twice a week. And each time you probably need to apply about a half inch of water to those plants. I often suggest that if you are living in an area where you have a chance to plant them on the south side of a building where the drip line happens to be, so each night or each day there's dripping that comes down there, and set those out about a foot beyond that drip line. That way you have some natural watering when you're on vacation and things like that. But water is the biggest issue. If they get stressed for a period of 2 weeks without water, it impacts the flowering and fruit production for the next year, and I'm guessing that's probably where your problem is. It's not pH.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for calling today. We have an email from Danette in Eau Claire wanting to know when is the best time to separate her hostas and how best to do that.
Hostas are pretty tough. You can, if you're kind to them after you separate them, you can almost do it any time. In the fall, after we've had frost, is a good time all the way up to you want to give them about 3 weeks before freeze-up so they grow some new roots. In the spring, when they begin to grow, the best time is when they first begin to grow and you have those little buds about, maybe an inch or less tall, and then dig up the plant and you can separate it. You can be kind and break them off, or you just take a knife to it and cut them into sections. But the secret is after you transplant them, make sure you place them on a good watering schedule for about 3-4 weeks. And I would suggest watering them at least 2-3 times a week, and then even utilizing some mulch will help. But hostas are pretty forgiving. I've split and transplanted them midsummer, and if you put them on a watering program, they'll survive.
All right. That was an email from Danette, and you can email your questions for Bob Tomesch to talk@WPR.org. Of course, you can always call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Bob Tomesch from the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and Extension about just about anything that's going on as we are making this transition from summer to fall and looking ahead to winter and then next spring. I'm Laurie Skelton, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's another edition of Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurie Skelton sitting in for Larry Mueller, and Bob Tomesch is taking your questions and comments. Jane in Madison, good morning. How can we help you?
Well, actually, I have a couple questions now, but I'm wondering about reseeding an old lawn, that has a fair bit of grass, but it grows so poorly and has a lot of, bare spots. But not, the grass is predominant. Can you just seed over that with new seed?
Yes, you can. But we probably need to step back and look at what your problem is for having the poor lawn. Is that there's certain things that can cause it. Too much shade from your shade trees in certain areas. Compaction is usually a pretty good indicator of a poor lawn, and lawn aeration would be a good step. You can usually rent a lawn aerator that takes the cores, nothing that pokes into the soil, that squeezes the soil. You want those core plugs to pop out, and that's a good time to also overseed your lawn and drag the water it, and the seeds will kind of fall into the some of those holes and also where the core aeration is. But I would try to find out why you have such a poor lawn, because usually once a lawn is established, it's going to be there for a long period of time, and usually causes are compaction or just too much shade. We planted those shade trees and they've gotten bigger and they tend to filter out the light, and so sometimes just a matter of pruning some of our shade trees to allow more light into the yard will help improve the problem. Also, now is the fall is a good time to be fertilizing your lawn. And now that we've had a little bit of rain, I think we're on the safe side. I can see it starting to green back up. And fall is a good time to apply your fall application of fertilizer. And, of course, it depends on what type you're getting, but it'll give you recommendations on the bag as to how much to apply per 1,000 square feet.
Before you get to your next question, Jane, I've actually got a question. I'm noticing dandelions this late in the season for the first time ever in my backyard. Anything I can do about that at this point?
Are they flowering or just growing?
I actually saw a few flowers.
Yeah. Part of it is usually they don't flower till next spring, but the extreme drought we had this year throws them out of sync to some degree.
Okay.
And they actually were forced into a kind of a semi-dormant period, and as they come out of it, they will begin to flower. I did see one the other day blooming.
That was quite surprising.
A lot of the dandelions we see now, you know, they're sending out those rosettes, and this fall is also a good time if you choose to control your dandelions. If you're going to use any herbicide, this is probably the best time to control them, even better than spring.
Oh, okay, great. Jane, you said you had another question?
Back to the first question. I was just wondering if new seed varieties from, you know, my lawn is, say, 70 years old, and would new varieties of grass be better in terms of how it would grow?
No, you've got a problem with either too much sun or compaction or something. You might even want to check with a lawn service and have them evaluate what's causing the problem.
Okay.
Because in most situations, once you establish a lawn, take care of it, it's going to be in pretty good shape, and something's causing the problem there. The new varieties, I mean, sure, you can dig it up and replant it, and the newer seed varieties will give you uniformity. That's one of the problems when you come in with overseeding. The new varieties might be a little different shade of green, or you have little patches you plant, and people look out there and say, how come it's not uniform?
Right.
And part of it has to do with the variety. If you are going to replant the whole lawn, use the same variety. It'll look more uniform.
Yeah. The other thing is just clearing an area for new grass, taking out a lot of violets.
Mm.
Do you have to get out all the little roots?
And more.
They'll all resprout.
Yeah, there's seeds there, too.
Yeah, right. But
now, that
roots
tells me a little bit, now that you say you fessed up, you have some violets. I'm guessing you have probably overshade.
Yeah.
Too much shade in your situation.
Yeah.
And they're coming in because the turf they're all competing the turf grass right now.
Right.
And controlling dandelions is a real stress situation. There are some herbicides you can come in to try to knock them down a little bit and fertilize your turf grass and let that outcompete the dandelions. But I think your biggest problem is trying to open up that yard, maybe do some pruning, take out the lower branches to allow the sun to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your turf grass probably will come back much thicker as well. And it might be a lot cheaper than coming in and reseeding your lawn.
Right, great. Thank you.
Jane, thank you for calling. We've got an email from Donna in Madison. We have a river birch tree that has branches hanging on the roof. When is the best time to prune the branches?
Well, the best time in a situation like that, you probably want to prune before they do very much damage, because when they're rubbing on the roof, they're peeling off the sand particles, and it's going to deteriorate your roof. Also, your roof doesn't dry out properly, and it can lead to some rot problems. But so in that situation, now. Generally, pruning, we suggest waiting until about March to do the types of regular pruning to maintain it. But you're in a situation that you look at it as similar to a broken branch or causing damage, and you need to get in there and take out some of those branches right now.
Okay. And from Sheila in Merrill, another email. My husband planted a hibiscus in a flower bed before he realized it's not going to make it through the winter. Can we cover it with a barrel? Should we take it out? What do we do with the hibiscus?
Yeah. Up there, that's a zone 3. What I would do in the situation like that, if you leave it out, even if we mulch over it, the chances of survival are going to be pretty slim. Even down here in the Madison area, which I refer to the banana belt, when you come out of northern Wisconsin, you've got a longer growing season. It's much kinder to your plants. But even down here, we have certain varieties of hibiscus that don't do very well. So what you can do is you could dig that hibiscus and move it indoors in a potted situation and just kind of try to keep it through the winter, and then in the spring set it back out. That would be one possibility. Some people will kind of move them into a garage area, dig them, place them in a pot, and then water that soil about once a month. But it should be in a garage that's, you know, the temperature sure gets down to freezing, because they're going to need a certain amount of that temperature in order to stimulate flower buds and things like that. So maybe the moving indoors is not going to be the best part.
Well,
but you can move it into a garage in a pot and water that pot. And if it got into freezing, fine, but you don't want to drop those temperatures below zero.
So, and for someone who has hibiscus in pots, what's the best way to move them from outside to in? What's the best way to make them indoor plants again?
Oh, okay. A lot of the hibiscus we grow indoors are developed for the growing indoors.
And so you can just pick them up and take them indoors and they won't blink. They'll be perfectly fine.
No, they're going to go through. That's a good question. Moving plants indoors this time of the year, you know, we have to do it one before frost.
Okay.
And so people move them indoors, and then they have the encounter first thing is loss of leaves. And part of it has to do is our indoor environments are so dry, leaves dry out. We also bring our little friendly critters inside. And so using some type of pest management or insecticidal soap will work and you need to apply that about 3-4 times in the first month.
Okay.
Right after, because what you're doing is knocking down the adult population and also the egg population. So we're moving indoors, but I often, if you've ever moved, I'll tell you the best thing to try to move in and really see it happen is something like an impatience. The first thing they do is lose all their leaves and all their flower buds and leaves out at the tips, cut them right back down to a base and let the new leaves develop. And as the new leaves develop, they will then be acclimated to their indoor environment.
Okay.
Also, sunlight is very important. You want to have fairly good, you know, almost direct sun, because after November, light intensity plays a very definite role in trying to maintain our plant materials through those following 3 months.
All right, great. Ruth in Wausau, thank you so much for waiting this morning. How can we help you?
Okay, it's a long time. We've got a 20-year-old yellow delicious apple tree. Last year it had no apples. This year it's loaded with apples. They're misshaped. They're gnarled. We've never had any decent apples on it.
And have you cut the apples open? What do you find on the inside?
They're just gnarled. If we don't spray with bug spray, then of course there's the worms and wormholes and so on. But they're kind of brown and gnarled inside.
Okay. Well, first of all, Yellow Delicious is kind of a borderline variety for that far north. And you're going to have some years that you'll have flowers and some years not. The other thing that could be happening is biennial bearing, where certain varieties have a heavy crop 1 year, light crop, and they'll go back and forth. So that's probably what's happening there. The gnarliness and unusual shape are caused by either fungal infections that happen on the outside, like cedar apple rust, or the second thing would be the different insects like apple maggot. Usually when the adult fly lays an egg on the outer surface, there's just a small dimple, but it kills cells in that area, and so you have indentations. And it's the insect activity, that plump curculio, and all of those types of things. So with Delicious, or Yellow Delicious that you have, one, they're not disease resistant. So in your pest management program, and there's a very good extension bulletin on growing apples in Wisconsin, and it'll make suggestions as to what products to apply and how often. And it's very important to, once you decide to go that pesticide route, is to start early in the spring. In fact, the first application is in the dormant phase of the tree.
We did that. Soil. We did it. We applied it three times.
Three times.
Powder.
Three times.
Mix with water, and then that's for apple trees.
Three times is not enough. You have to do it about every 7 to 10 days, the entire growing season. So you're looking at least 12 to 14 applications. And when you apply that product, what you're doing is protecting that fruit, so when either the insect or the disease gets there, it can't get started and either lay an egg or whatever it's going to do. Applying it three times, you know, sure, you probably controlled it for a period of 7 days, but what happened to the after that 7 days? And that's why you have that problem.
Okay. I think that's what the directions said on the ortho, I don't know if I can mention that name, powder mix.
Mm-hmm. Is it one you mixed with water?
Yes.
Yeah. But you have to keep applying it. Three shots is not going to be enough.
All right, Ruth, thank you for calling. And Carol in Dubuque has been waiting. Carol, thank you for calling today.
thank you. Since that was an Apple question, I have one more. There's no way I can keep up with that spraying schedule, being that I'm so busy. If I bag the fruit in plastic bags, some of the apples, do I have to do any spraying, or can I just bag the fruit, and when do I do that?
Okay, bagging fruit is something that's an idea that's come on, and for a homeowner, it might be something you might want to consider. Let's just back up when to do it and why we're doing it. I have found that using plastic sandwich bags that have the zip top on them work probably the best. I usually cut the corners opposite the zipping end, and that allows excess moisture out. You apply it to the fruit when they're about the size of a dime on your fruit tree. And so you're talking about 10 days after petal drop. And you slide the bag up, and I use a hand stapler and go on each side of the stem, and there's usually a cluster of five still there. And I take a scissors and snip off the other four and then go and bag. And you can bag probably 40 apples in an hour. Most people never eat more than 200 apples, so 4 or 5 hours, you're all done. You never have to apply. So the insects, when they get there, they can't get through diseases, and it does work very well. One other suggestion, if you're going to grow fruit trees like that, I would suggest getting disease-resistant varieties, and there's some very good ones out there, like Nova Easy Grow, Liberty, Red Free. In that extension bulletin, fruit cultivars for Wisconsin, you'll find a list of disease-resistant apples. We eat the fruit, but we also have to think about the leaves on the tree. And when you use disease-resistant varieties, the diseases like apple scab and cedar apple rust does not infect those leaves. And so you have healthier leaves, healthier trees, and it imparts a healthier fruit on your tree.
All right. Carol, you also wanted to know something about tomatoes today.
Yes. I have 500 tomatoes in my garden, and 4 are red.
Okay.
So I'm ready to hit the panic button. And I'm thinking, okay, if we get frost, I'm going to put some of that insulation board around the sides of my garden, and then I'm going to throw a plastic, clear plastic tarp on top. Then when my husband leaves for work, he can whip that off during the day. You know, and I can't lose these tomatoes.
Well.
Well, what,
so you think I could...
Have you ever thought of pickles?
More time?
Well, you got two issues. One, you want to protect them from frost, and clear plastic will do the same thing, and probably just, you know, same as blankets. What you're doing is trapping the heat that comes from the soil and keeping it around the plant so the less apt to freeze. But you're going to be up against another little problem, and that's heat units. Once you get below 55 degrees, the tomatoes stop growing. They sit there, and the word vegetate comes on. In other words, they just sit there. And they will not ripen anymore, and they will not be sweet. And our number of days for above 50 are getting rather limited. Now, this year, you're not the only one complaining your tomatoes aren't ripening. I'm dealing with people that grow grapes and everything else. We're about 14 to 17 days behind average in terms of growing. So I think you're in southern Wisconsin, but it's almost like trying to grow tomatoes up in the Spooner area. So you know what they deal with every year.
Okay.
Okay, well, I was even thinking of putting like a swimming pool, plastic swimming pool in there with water in between the plants. Maybe that would keep the temperature up a little.
I would take some clear plastic and throw it over it, and it acts like a miniature greenhouse, and you can get a roll that's 12 feet wide and put it down a segment. I wouldn't do the whole garden, but I would do a few number of plants. What you're going to do is, remember that magic 55 degrees I mentioned, what you're going to do on a day that's 70, you're going to have temperatures in the 80s and 90s, and so that'll increase the ripening.
But it sounds like a lot of us are just working against what we were hoping for this year in terms of tomatoes.
Heat, yep.
Okay. And we have now Haley from Randolph is on the line. How can we help you today?
I heard the first question that was sent in about cover crops.
Yes.
And my question is kind of the opposite. I'm looking for a cover crop for something to last in spring and through summer, because we have a house with a lot of beautiful flower beds, a big garden area, but we're getting ready to sell it. And so the big thing is we won't be here while we're selling it, and so we want something that we don't have to weed.
Well,
and also something that maybe would look attractive, obviously, to people coming looking at the house.
So you're looking at something around the, you still have the perennial flowers, right?
No, it would be like our garden area, vegetable garden area, so there will be nothing in there because we're not going to garden, obviously, while we're not here. And there are some flower beds that we're just having, like annual or bulbs that you had to dig up.
Yep. What I would do with those is seed them back to grass, and if that homeowner decides that he wants to have a green thumb and flower garden, he'll make flower beds wherever he wants. And I would just take and seed those areas back to lawn and mow it and maintain it that way and be a lot easier on your life.
Okay, well, they're not really mowable areas. Oh. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of raised up. They're actual beds that have been made and the garden areas that have been made with a fence and that kind of stuff around it.
The other thing you could do is put something like a landscape fabric down and place some bark chips about 2 inches over that, and then they could work around that when they decide to come in.
Okay.
All right. Haley, thank you for calling. And we have Judy in Two Harbors on the line. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. How
can we help?
Well, my problem is slugs. We're having a terrible infestation of them in the garden and lawns, every place. And, of course, they're eating everything, leaves and vegetables and... How can we control them? I don't know what we can do this year, but going forward in the spring, I'm really worried, especially for my vegetable garden.
Yep, and I'm guessing you mulched your vegetable garden.
No, we did not. Some had black plastic and some did not.
Okay, black plastic, what they're doing is living under that shaded area is where I was getting to.
Okay,
one of the things now in the fall is they got to live on something.
Right.
And hide under something. So what you want to do is pull the mulch off the black plastic as soon as we get a frost and you're done gardening, and actually till that soil, open it up, but take any plant material that's there out of there.
Okay.
And move that to a compost peel. So what you're doing is starving them along the way. There's also some slug products out there, like I think Slug Be Gone or something like that, spreading that around. That'll help. One of the things when you start gardening next spring is to keep this 2-foot area around the garden because a lot of your slugs move from the turf grass into the garden. And so if you keep that tilled, they go out so far and they can't find any food and they go back to the lawn where they can eat.
Oh, okay.
So that'll work.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I also noticed them in raised beds, and these raised beds are very old. They were there when we moved in a couple of years ago. Are they in the wood there or hiding someplace?
They're hiding under wood, under plant material and everything else. You might want to just take a look at some of the slug bait materials, the products that are out there, and that'll kind of reduce your population, and then you can start from there.
Alrighty, thank you very much.
Judy, thank you for calling. Rick is on the line. Rick, hello there.
Hi, how are you, folks?
Just fine.
I'm feeling guilty about eating my two red ripe tomatoes here in northern Wisconsin.
Good for you. You beat the
odds. Out my window.
How can we help today?
I have had a recurring problem with mushrooms, like fairy rings, growing in my grass. I mean, they're not ubiquitous, but there are half a dozen of them, and I really haven't had any luck other than taking a golf club and whacking them off. But they keep coming back. A fungicide I tried was basically for garden pests, and it didn't do very much at all. Do you have any advice?
Yep. I think your golf club one is not too bad. The reason the fungi are there are one of two things. One, they're living on some dead wood material that's down in there, and back before the lawn was done, there might have been a root or a stump, and they're growing off of that. Those are the straight line ones. The actual fairy rings are just kind of a clumping of mycelium, or similar to mushroom roots, that tend to have in a circle, and they just keep going out farther and farther. About the only, there are no good fungicides for that. What you might want to do is just mowing regularly when they do appear. Usually the fungi, those sporing producing heads, are only prominent for probably 3 weeks out of the year, and that's when it's going through its adult flowering structure, supposedly flowering, but that's when it's releasing spores.
I'm seeing these mushrooms even now, and they've been there all summer long in the same places.
I'm guessing that you have dead roots and wood materials down in there. And you could try going down with a probe. If you find the root, digging the root out, you'll remove the food source for that fungi.
And they've been there 30-some years then. This is an old farm field.
Yep.
Well, I guess I'll get the rake out and just knock off the mushrooms. I wish they were edible, although they may be, but I'm not going to try it.
You're not going to find out.
Yeah, you want to be pretty sure on those.
You bet. Thanks.
Yeah, just keep practicing with the golf club. Thank you, Rick. Now, an email from Karen in Madison. We purchased a new home and discovered wild grapes growing on the fence. They're very purple and very tart. When is the best harvesting time and what can we do with them? Are we looking at wine here?
Well, probably not.
Okay.
Usually the wild grapes, the riparia types, tend to have high acid, low sugars, and she's right, they are very tart. If they have any size to them, you could always make jelly, and the antidote to the tartness is to add sugar.
Yes.
So use a good sugar recipe. But they're probably at their peak ripening right now, and so you have an option there if you would choose to. Go with a cultivated grape. You get all kinds of good production and better quality. And all those things.
And if you've got wild grapes on the fence, you know that a cultivated grape is going to grow.
Right.
Okay. And we turn next to Jackie in Milwaukee. We've got another hibiscus question.
Good morning. Well, my problem is I have six beautiful resurrection lilies, if you know what they are, the miracle lilies that end up the green and then it dies back and then they come up. Well, there were six.
Right.
They're gorgeous.
Yes.
But you can't see them because I have a perennial hibiscus bush that overshadowed them. It's like growing a young forest next to my back door. I want to take out those resurrection lilies. How do I, when do I? Right now they've stopped blossoming. They have the stalk with the little seed pods on the top. When can I dig them out and where can I, I know where to put them, but...
I've moved some of those little rascals. Now let me share the experience. I've done them in the spring. As soon as they emerge, you see the little green tops, so you know where they are. But you're going to have bulbs down there, 8 inches sometimes. So you have to really dig a large soil ball to move them. And I moved some last spring and watered them in, and they were probably about 2 inches tall when I dug those. And I dug about 16 inches deep, and I know I still slid some bulbs in half. But I watered them, and I did get a few flowers yet, even this fall, and I'm assuming that next year, because of the environment, they should flower a lot better.
Okay. And we are talking today with Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer at the Department of Horticulture for the UW-Madison and Extension, and we are talking with you. Your calls and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Laurie Skelton sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And good morning. Welcome back to Garden Talk with Bob Tomesch from the UW-Madison and Extension from the Department of Horticulture. We are taking your calls and comments this morning. Kathleen in Lamont, Illinois is joining us. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, and thank you very much. I have a question on a 10 to 15-year-old evergreen tree that we have that the needles have completely turned brown throughout the whole tree, and I don't know if it's dead or if it will come back next year. Our neighbor also had the same thing happen, and they cut their tree down but just kind of left it in their backyard.
Yeah. Is it a blue spruce?
I believe so.
Yeah. I hate to tell you this, but it's dead or near death. There are certain fungal diseases that do get involved with blue spruce primarily, and we many times don't even recommend them as a landscape plant anymore because of the environment that we have here. We just have too much humidity. The blue spruce originated in the dry environments of the mountains, and when we bring them to our wet climate here in Wisconsin, they pick up several diseases. Many times you see branches dying on the bottom and it works its way up, and I'm guessing that's probably what you observed in your plant. So I would remove it and start with something different.
Something different. Okay, thank you very much.
Black Hill spruce would be a good choice if you want to stay with an evergreen. It's kind of adapted to our environment. Any of the white spruces would be very good.
All right. And our next caller is Lenny in Woodruff. Good morning, Lenny.
Thank you for taking my call, and good morning to you also. My question is, I want to thin out some phlox. They're the tall ones, and they're now going into seed, so I'm assuming it would be a good time to do it.
Right, and what a good time to be digging those would be digging them water your soil up there. It's probably a little dry. You might have had a slight frost already. But dig, and I would save about an 8-inch stem on the plant material. They're still alive, and that will kind of help them pick up the photoperiod responses and those types of things. But you can dig up the whole bed and then just replant those into hills or whatever. Good time to have friends and donate plant materials to others and let them expand their perennial garden.
And the best kind of recycling. Lenny, thank you for your call. A couple more emails coming in from Bill in Menominee. Do you have a suggestion for a border perennial that would be at the edge of a driveway, shaded all winter, but in full sun in the summer?
Okay. Of course, some of the real tough ones would be like alpine currant or some of those types of plants. They can tolerate almost any type of condition. They're fairly tough. It depends on how much wind you're having. You could possibly go with some of the cedars, but usually those tend to have some winter damage, and also the deer love to eat those. Some of the lilacs and some of those types of things. It depends if you want flowering or not.
Miss Kim lilacs?
Yes.
Okay.
The other thing is there's a bulletin on selecting landscape trees or woody landscape plants for Wisconsin. And if I were you, I'd get a hold of that because we have that broken down into different types of plants and plants that can be made into a hedge. And in there, that'll give you a list. And so I would suggest going that route. And that we also give the zonation in there in your zone 3, okay. Almost 4. So, again, picking some woody plant materials for that environment.
All right. And another email. Grace in Madison wants to know, when is the best time to have trees professionally trimmed? Specifically, she has a grand old spruce she's worried about.
Usually, most of the pruning we recommend after probably February. And usually February till the time when we start seeing some growth in the spring, and there's about a 6-week window, is the best time to be doing any pruning on those.
And you can email your questions and comments to talk@wpr.org. Back to the phones right now for George in Mercer. Good morning, George.
Morning. It's a beautiful morning in the Northwoods.
Good.
Birches are just starting to turn.
And how can we help you?
I've got a bunch of vinca I want to transplant, and I wondered whether I should do it this fall or wait till spring.
With vinca, that's kind of course, you get plenty of snow up there, and that gives a little mulch protection. But I would wait till spring and try to move those as soon as the soil thaws in the spring. If you move them now, vinca is one of those touchy types of plants. Sometimes if you move them this time of the year and winter comes on sooner than we anticipate, it can be somewhat hazardous. So I'd wait till spring.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. We have an email from Robin in Hudson. Regarding slugs, is it too late to incorporate nematodes?
You're going to have better luck with nematodes because what happens now as we move into fall, and I'm not sure if you're using the nematodes to control the slugs, if that's what your target is, but you're going to have best luck in the spring because your nematodes are going to multiply in their populations. You're going to target them. They're going to be more active. We're at a stage now where the soils are going to start cooling, and some of those types of critters are going to want to work their way down in the soil. We have that especially prominent with some of the white grubs. And you can probably notice that soon the skunks and all the other critters that renovate the backyard for grubs are just going to quit doing it, and that's because they have to dig too deep. And they'll move on to other things to eat. But I would wait till spring and do the application there. With nematodes, the other thing is they'll have recommendations as to some of the best times for control. And you want your population down, your target population. And your target population is probably near height right now. A lot of it's not going to survive the winter. In the spring, if you apply it, you're going to knock down part of the overwintering existing population.
Okay, and back to the phones right now to Roman in Wausau. Another apple tree question this morning.
Good morning. I have Fireside Delicious apple tree in my backyard. It's getting a little bit big now. It's been about 8 years, and every year, finding these, they look like a moth, I guess, that comes around, lays their eggs, and we get the worms and the apple, and most years I have been able to harvest and at least make applesauce out of these. This year, for whatever reason, I do have these vinegar traps that have been catching a lot of these moths, but not enough of them, I'm sure. But anyway, this year, I don't know whether it's the season partly or whatever, but the apples have just dropped, and I've had over like 250 of them that I've picked up green. They never even got near ripe, and I planted a Honeycrisp in the front yard this year, just a young tree, and I see I'm getting about 18 nice apples on that tree. I've eaten a couple already, and it doesn't seem like the worms that are attacking that one. I did put a trap out there also and caught hardly any. I'm just wondering, number one, if the Honeycrisp is resistant to these moths and their worms, or if so, I'm going to chop that fireside down, plant on a Honeycrisp, or what should I do this fall, perhaps, because they tell me that these worms get down in the soil and come out of it, the soil in the spring. You can tell me if that's accurate, and if there's some kind of a poison. I don't like to spray poisons on my apple trees when they're growing, but maybe on the ground to kill these things as they're coming out in the spring, or what can I do to either try and preserve that fireside tree as big and nice as it is, or what? Where do I go from here, I guess? I would cut it down, plant another Honeycrisp if there's no saving it.
Well, first of all, Honeycrisp is not resistant to the insect. They're just not over there yet. But you are right in the life cycle. And the reason the green apples are falling off is the codling moth larvae have eaten out the seeds, and so there's no reason for the fruit to stay on the tree, and that's why they're falling prematurely. Your best bet is to come in with some type of pesticide program. Again, I suggested growing apples in Wisconsin. It'll list what pesticides to use. And the other thing is, this was a year where we had a very high codling moth adult population flight, which meant more eggs and more infections.
All right. We have an email from Bobby in Stoughton that I think a lot of us are asking. The best time to transplant bulbs. She comments that right now, foliage has all died back. Perennials have taken over. She doesn't know where the bulbs are exactly. She'd rather wait until spring when she can see shoots again. What should she be doing?
Well, if you wait till you see shoots and you move those bulbs, usually you will have no flowering that year because the flower bud is there, and in the shock from transplanting is going to eliminate the flower structure. So you can kind of dig down in the soil and just kind of randomly hope that you find some of the bulbs. Usually they're in clumps, and they're going to be down there anywhere from 4 to 6 inches, and just kind of use a spading fork instead of a spade, and so you have less chance of damage. But you can dig through that soil, and it's a good time to aerate the soil. Think of it that way, preparing that bed. And when you find some of those bulbs, you can recluster them. But I would move, if you're going to move them now in the fall. This is a good time because we suggest 4 to 6 weeks before freeze-up so the bulb has a chance to establish some new roots for absorbing nutrients and water.
And that's for transplant, but new bulbs, tulips, daffodils, go in right now?
Start planting. You've probably got another 4 to 6 weeks to be planting our bulbs, and they're available at the garden centers now.
All right. And we turn now a quick call to Carrie in Cudahy. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning. Question, I have a rubber tree plant. Okay, I got it from a funeral about 3-4 years ago. My wife went out and bought a bigger pot for it after having it for about a year. Well, it took off, it got about 4 foot high. So, yeah, and a beautiful plant. So I moved it outside to the back patio in a nice shade area, and it's been out there all summer, spring and summer. Well, now it's about 6 foot high. And I don't know if I want to sell it for a office plant, or can I plant it in the backyard? Because I really don't see it coming back in the house.
Okay. Well, you can raise the ceiling in one of the rooms. A couple of options that you have there. You can try selling it, but that's not going to be, somebody buys it, fine. You've got something. Rubber trees grow very fast. What some people do is prune it way back down to a small, and then just let it grow some new branches. Wherever there were little buds or old leaf tissue, there's going to be new shoots, and you can really go back in and prune them. You could actually prune it almost back down to the base of the pot, and it'll send up some new shoots from the root system. So you've got some options there. Either severe pruning, move it back in. Of course, if you sell it, you know, it's gone for good.
Okay. Now, we're going to be taking a break for news and weather at the top of the hour in just a moment. But, Bob, if you could just remind us all what UW Extension has to offer, just in case you don't get through on the phones or through email today.
Well, we do have the publications which are available, and you can go on the Internet and track us down. It's learningcenter.com.
Learning Center, one word?
Learningstore.com.
Learningstore.com, one word.
And you can go in and you can find extension bulletins on many of the subjects that I've mentioned, and I've even referred to some of those bulletins. That's a very good source. You can check with your local county extension office, and they can direct you to some of the publications. They may even have some available, or they could print some off for you on certain topics. And so that's also a very good source of information. We have a number of workshops. I know Spooner this Saturday is having a field day out at their in their vegetable area. And I think that starts at 9 o'clock. And there's a group from Chippewa Falls that are kind of hosting it. But we got everything set up there. And we did have some watermelon trials. And I went through, and there are, I think, 16 selections out there that did ripen. So there's a lot to see, and there's a lot of opportunities.
And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Lori Skelton, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Garden Talk will be back after the news from National Public Radio and continuing on until 12:30, at which time we'll hear Chapter a Day. I'm Lori Skelton, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and today we are talking with Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer of the Department of Horticulture for UW-Madison and Extension. And it's transition time. It's only a few days until the first day of autumn. And whether it's outdoor plants coming indoors or plans for next year, we have questions about grapes and blueberries, companion planting, and indigo plants just waiting. And we're waiting for your call at 1-800-642-1234. Email your questions to talk@WPR.org. We'll be back with you and your questions after the news. Good afternoon, and welcome back to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio on the Ideas Network. I'm Lori Skelton, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and with Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer of the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and Extension. We are taking your calls and emails until 12:30. Aaron, thank you for your patience. Aaron in River Falls, how can we help you?
Hi, I was wondering about any resources or like good books or anything like that that would be on companion planting. I'm reinventing my garden this year, and I am looking for ideas of different things to do. I also had another question about raspberries. I have raspberries, and last year, it hasn't happened this year, but last year I got my raspberries, and they had this like yellow pollen kind of stuff on it that would not wash off. And I ate them, but it didn't seem to affect the taste or anything like that. I was wondering if you have any ideas what that could be.
Are those black raspberries?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
The problem, the orangeness on there is called orange rust. And that's a fungal problem. It's vascular. In other words, it overwinters inside the plant. It's usually on the leaf tissue. I doubt you might see some on the fruit, but usually it ends up killing the plants. And so that's something to consider. You might want to look at some other variety, like some of the reds and replanting. And they even suggest planting red raspberries about 300 feet, which, you know, most backyards don't have that much space, away from the black raspberries, just so you don't spread the disease to the reds. As for companion planting, I would go to like Rodale Press or one of those sources. Do a Google, and you're going to find a fair number of book materials on companion planting and what works and the time of the season that works best for certain types of coupling up of different types of plant materials.
All right. Thank you for calling. We have an email from Joan of Marshfield, who has a false indigo plant and would like to transplant it to give it some room. It's been in the garden for a little over 2 years and has just one stem with a 3-foot spread of branches. Fall or spring better for moving a false indigo plant?
False indigo, I would try it right in the spring. I haven't ever moved one of those, but I've heard of people that have. They have a very extensive root system underneath, and so you have to dig a pretty good-sized soil ball to get that plant up and moving. I would say spring, as soon as the soil thaws, get out there, try to move it, water it well, and hopefully you can, you know, get it moved to another location or split it or whatever you're going to do with it. But they are a difficult plant to move.
All right. Thank you for that email. You email us at talk@wpr.org, or you call us like Steve in Wapaka did. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. My question is, my dad had planted some blueberries probably about 50 years ago. They've been there as long as I can remember. And, of course, my dad passed away a while back, and my mom is 91, and I'm trying to figure out how to save some of the strains without digging out the plant. Can I either take some shoots and get some roots to start, or could I bend some over and put some dirt on top of them or soil on top of them and hold them down and go root start? I'm trying to figure out how to get some slip started off of it without actually removing the plants.
Well, blueberries are very difficult to propagate and move. You almost have to move the whole plant, and then the success ratio is somewhat limited.
And usually, I guess I should say, I probably wouldn't really care about moving them except that they're kind of an heirloom to our family now. So,
yeah. What I would do is dig, you know, not all the plants at one time, but dig half of them or whatever you want to move, and cut back most of the above growth, because they're going to send up new shoots and suckers from the base. And in about 2 years, you should be into blueberry production at the new site.
Okay, probably the best way is to take them out completely then. Huh?
Yeah, I would do it that way. Can't, taking root cuttings or any of the other traditional types of cutting slips, layering like you're suggesting, just doesn't work well for blueberries.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Steve, thank you very much for calling. And we're going next to Vince in Milwaukee. I may have said the wrong thing. He's got another question about grapes and wine. Hi, Vince.
Hi. Yes, my question is I have a 45-year-old Concord grape plant, and I'm moving, and I was wondering if I could propagate it from either the seeds or the roots, or how would I go about doing that?
Okay. Propagating grapes is very easy. One, you don't want to go with seeds because you don't know where the pollen came from, and you'll end up with all kinds of interesting results. With grapes, I often suggest is just taking a stem cutting. That would be last season's growth. When you do your pruning normally, you take those prunings, cut them into about 3 bud segments, and plant them right in the garden someplace where you want to start them, and they'll root right at those nodes. Yeah, you don't have to use any rooting compound or anything, and you're in the grape business, and you can go from a plant to a vineyard and nothing flat.
Okay. And we turn now to Kathy in Egg Harbor. Kathy, you left an orange tree with your neighbor, and you're not happy with the way it came back to you. Is that it?
Oh, I haven't got it back. We're still up in Egg Harbor because Door County is, you know, fabulous.
Yeah.
But anyway, I entrusted her with this little orange tree that had been grown from the garden club from seed. And over, I say, you know, 3 years, it is now 6 foot tall. And it's just, I bring it in, I leave it out on my deck in Illinois, you know, all summer. And then I bring it in the winter, and it's done just fabulously. Well, I visited Illinois recently, and all over many of the branches is this, like, black crud with ants crawling over it and black spots on the leaves. And so I got soap and water, and I washed, and the black came right off the leaves. But, you know, there's these big spikes on the stems, which you really can't wash them off without getting stabbed. You know?
Right. Mm. Very thorny.
You're right. So I'm wondering, can this plant be saved? Because it's not 100% covered with this, but I'm also worried about bringing it back into the house. Would it get on my other house plants? And
I don't know exactly what it sounds like. You may have a fungal problem, but if the ants are there, they're also probably eating either the spores from the fungus or some little critters that's living in there. You know, they're farming your plant.
Hmm.
Farming on your plant. I'm not real familiar with the oranges, I'll be honest with that, but it sounds like a couple of things. One, you might want to use some insecticidal soap and bring them indoors and see what happens. As to the disease, it depends on what type it is, but sometimes we have diseases like that starting on plants that are starting to deteriorate. In other words, there are certain, it's reaching an age where they're becoming stressed and they're just slowly dying and they start weeping or doing things like that. So that may be a possibility, but you know, I would wash it down with insecticidal soap or something like that and see what you end up with.
Would it hurt to just cut the branches off that have the black on them, or would that be too severe on the plant?
No, oranges are pretty tough. You can cut those back quite severely, and then they'll tend to bush out.
All right. I thought I might try that, too. So.
Okay, Kathy, thank you very much, and good luck with your orange tree.
Thank you.
And a quick reminder, the toll-free number, 1-800-642-1234. Garden Talk continues until 12:30 today on Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple of emails to get to from Ann in McHenry, Illinois. A lawn service company is trying to sell our neighbor on something called liquid aerating. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of it, but I never delved into that one very in depth. I would suggest checking with their local county extension office or getting it to a turf grass specialist, and they can give you a little better handle on that.
Okay, that's a new one on me. And from Jane in Fond du Lac, a limelight hydrangea is getting smaller each year. How do I save it?
Well, one might be the location. They do like full sun, and if you have a semi-shaded area, if you planted it too close to the house, it's probably not getting enough water because it's just maybe under the overhang of the roof or something like that.
Okay.
So the way to save it, put it on a watering program. Might have to move it to a better location. It's water, sunlight, and a little bit of nutrients, and see what happens.
All right. Email at talk@wpr.org. Back to the phones at the moment, though. Jim in Wisconsin Dells. Hi there.
Hi.
What's up?
I've got tomatoes that have this white growth inside of them. I don't know if it's a deficiency of some kind.
White growth.
Yeah, when you...
They look kind of corky white.
Inside it, yeah.
It's okay. That comes about from nutrient stress, usually magnesium and calcium. And if you haven't watered consistently during the whole growing season, that'll happen. Also, certain varieties are more prone to that than others. But it's a lack of nutrients getting into the fruit due to water stress.
Okay, well, I water them with a soaker hose. And they do all the plants have blight this year.
Yeah.
All the plants have blight this year.
Well, yes. We're talking about something different now. The blight is the some of the leaf spots and that type of thing. And, mm-hmm. and yes, we did have a year that we do have a lot of blight, and the leaf tissue is collapsing. But have you fertilized with anything in particular?
Yeah, I'm up in the sand country, yeah. And so I basically use 13-13-13.
Yeah. But the problem you have isn't with those, what you're talking about is nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. The problem has to do with the calcium getting there.
Okay, well, I did put calcium down, but in sand, I don't know if they say the books say to put it on in the fall or put it on, dress it.
In the sand. Sand doesn't hold nutrients very well.
Right, it doesn't hold anything very well.
Try to improve the organic content in your soil.
Okay.
That'll tend to help a little bit. The other thing is when you fertilize, you know, make sure you don't overdo it, but there are some fertilizer products that are soluble out there.
I did that one year, yeah. Miracle-Gro.
Miracle-Gro, and following those recommendations, they have that and watering. And usually when you water a half inch probably every 4 days because the sand won't hold much more than 3/4 of an inch of water. And so what you're doing with the watering, you might be overwatering. It's washing any nutrients that might be available to the plant, washing it down below the root zone.
Well, I have these soaker hoses are 1/2 to 5/8 in diameter.
Yeah.
And I put it on a timer, and I water every row for 2 hours.
How often?
Well, that's a good question. When I think they need it, when we don't have any natural rain coming down.
I thought, you know, some people water every day, and that gets to be a little bit too much.
I get too many rows.
Yeah. I'm just guessing it has to do with either, you know, drought stress or just not enough magnesium, calcium primarily that causes that whiteness, and I think it's more of a magnesium issue. And using the Miracle-Gro product, try going that route and see if that does improve it a little bit for next year.
So it's been a bad year for blight, you say?
Well, yeah, on tomatoes, there's early blights primarily, and the septorias and a whole host of blights. And then we get into some of the wilts, like Fusarium verticillium. But we haven't seen too much of that this year, but it's more of the leaf tissue. With the tomatoes, you want to rotate them to a different area of the garden. You might want to use mulches because many of those spores that cause the blight come up from the soil. They overwinter in the soil, old leaf tissue. So there are some preventative strategies that people can do. But weather conditions play a great role in this. And if we have the proper environment for growth on those leaf tissues, we have a lot of blight. And certain varieties are more prone to blight than others.
Now, if you've got a garden that doesn't allow you to rotate your crops, if you've only got a small amount of sunlight, how do you handle it then?
Well, then what you want to do is any plant refuse, like tomatoes, once they freeze, get them out of the garden because you don't want it to overwinter the diseases within the plant tissue. I would highly recommend going to some type of mulch program. Also, there's a bulletin on it's vegetable varieties for Wisconsin, which we update every other year. But select those varieties that are resistant to blight. Some of the heirloom varieties like Brandywine, are very susceptible to the leaf blights. But there are some newer ones that are more resistant. You might want to try going into some of those, mulching around the base of the plant so that we don't have that splash up onto the leaf tissue. People will even remove the leaves on the lower portion of the plant up to a height of about 8 to 12 inches. And so to reduce the chance of infections in that zone.
All right. Now back to the phones right now, and Brian in Madison, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a question about shrubs. My wife's telling me now's not a good time to plant some shrubs, and I'm thinking, you know, we've got this little patch by our house that doesn't really have anything in it. It's just some soil. And I'd like to plant some shrubs there that are sort of native to this area so I don't have to do a lot to maintain them. Is now a bad time, like she says, or are there some varieties that now would be okay to plant?
Now's a good time. You've got probably till about mid-October. What you do transplant, make sure that you water them very definitely. I don't know where you're getting your plant material, but if it's ready containerized from a nursery, hey,
yeah,
that's ideal type, and this is a good time. You get some fairly good deals on the materials because they do not want to overwinter them. And so I would go with planting now.
Okay, and then what's a good variety? I don't know. I'm thinking something that's hardy that I won't have to do a lot to, that maybe not even water for the Madison area.
Hmm. Well, you're going to have to water the first couple of years just to get them established. And you have to make some choices. Do you want to, when you select plants, is it for leaf color or is it for, you know, wildlife fruit? There's like chokeberry and some of those types of things. I would again go back to that selecting landscape plants for Wisconsin, and that bulletin has a whole host of different types of plant materials that are hardy to our area, and I would start there.
Okay, it's called Selecting
Landscape Plants for Wisconsin.
Okay. All right.
And if you have a computer, you can go on the internet and find it at learningstore.com.
All right, Brian, thank you for that call. Emailing us at talk@wpr.org is John in Mount Horeb. We put black plastic over the ground around cantaloupes, melons, and peppers to keep the ground warmer, but it makes planting and watering difficult, and I'd rather not use synthetic materials. Is there anything else I could use?
Usually we use the plastic on cantaloupe and melons for weed control, and the other thing has to do with heating the soil up, and so there are some advantages there. They do have some soaker hoses that you can put under the plastic before you lay that down. That'll take care of your watering problem. And there are even some dripper tubes that are available at some of the box stores and garden centers and other places that you can work into the system. As for other mulches, as soon as we go to the organic materials, straw, hay, and things like that, it helps keep the weeds down, but it also keeps the soil cooler. And with the melons, you want to try to get as much heat into the system as you possibly can. Or the last resort is ho, 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 and try to keep the weeds down that way.
All right. You can call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Garden Talk continues for another few minutes. We have a few more questions to get to, including Pat in La Crescent. Good morning.
Good morning. I heard the call about the peonies with the spots. I thought that I perhaps had botrytis blight, which I have had in the past. And I was told a long time ago to dig them up and throw them away. I thought I would try to treat them with fungicide or a home remedy, alcohol and water in proportions. What do you think?
Well, this time of the year, the black spots and that are basically cosmetic because those leaves are only going to last a couple, three more weeks and just live with it. If you had peonies and they started the rots down below, then it's more than botrytis.
Oh.
It's probably soft rots or something like that, or you may end up with slugs feeding on it. And there are some borers like the June beetle larvae and some of those that will start feeding on that tuberous root. And when they do so, they're not the cleanest eaters and they leave soft rot behind, and that can cause some problems. So, but with the leaf tissue, it's cosmetic now. Live with it next year. If you want to control it, then look at some type of pest management program.
Oh, I see. Okay. One other question. I have a fair-sized birch, river birch, and or maybe it isn't a river birch. I don't remember. We bought it and planted it. And the leaves have been very yellowy-green all summer, and I wondered if it was getting too much water or if it's too alkaline in the soil. We do have sandy soil.
Yeah, they like heavier soils to begin with, but one of the things you can do for that plant is put about 3-4 inches of bark chips out as far as the canopy will go. That'll keep the soil temperature cooler and less stress on the roots. When you have the sandy soil, high temperatures, so you start having root damage, then the birch borer comes in. It's just a kind of a deterioration that goes down. So I would suggest mulching the plant extensively right now, putting it on a weekly watering program, and maybe you can bring it back around so that it has a good start for next year.
Thank you for calling. Dan in New London, thanks for your patience this morning.
Thanks. Good morning. Say, I have a phlox. It's a beautiful white phlox. It stands about 2 to 3 feet tall, but it's got powdery mildew on the leaves this year, and also I wanted to move it, and I was wondering if this is a good time of year to move it, or shall I wait till spring, and can I split it?
Yes, you can split it. Well, first, let's go back. The powdery mildew is something that sits in on leaf tissue, and phlox are very prone to powdery mildew. There are some varieties that might be out there that are resistant to powdery mildew, and you might want to try going that, but you're focusing on your white plant. I would wait till you have a little frost to knock down the top vegetation, and then I would look at dividing that, dig up the plant, save stems about 6 to 12 inches on the plant structure, and then just divide it into small clumps, and you can have many white phlox.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Two emails about asparagus. Sue in Waukesha County had beetles in her asparagus plants this year. She was told to cut down the stalks to keep out the larvae for next year. When should she do that, and can she use the stalks for anything? And Mike in Sister Bay wants to talk about transplanting wild asparagus. Is that a good idea?
Well, let's go to the first one. Asparagus beetles, they're feeding right now, and I've seen larvae on the plants when I've looked at them very closely. I would suggest going the route of the insecticide. If you choose not to do that, insecticides chemical or insecticidal soaps, but they're getting fairly large, and it takes quite a bit to knock them off. But next year, plan on maintaining some type of either insecticidal soap or on a regular basis. What you want to do is knock that population down. So that's for the asparagus beetle larvae.
And transplanting the wild?
Transplanting, lots of luck. part of it is what you see above ground, it's bigger down below. And we had a research project way back in the 80s up at Spooner, and we were going to see what kind of a root system on 3-year-old plants. We had a 4-foot-wide tree spade, and when we dug individual plants, the roots were beyond that.
Okay.
So it's tough to move.
Bob Tomesch from the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison Extension, thank you so much for taking our questions today. Thanks to Jim Packard for producing this edition of Garden Talk. Thanks to Sarah Carroll for on-air production, for taking your calls today, and to Brittany DeAnda for technical assistance. Thank you for listening, for your questions and comments. My apologies if we didn't get to you today, but catch Garden Talk next week at this time. I'm Laurie Skelton, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Wisconsin Public Radio.